From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in North Richmond.
Kentfield.
Oh, I live in San Jose near Campbell.
Bayview.
Coming up, we'll look at the true costs of the juvenile justice system in California.
There's a whole caseload of kids who have satisfied every other term and condition of their probation, but they just don't get off probation because they still owe money.
We'll examine how the price tag for incarcerating and rehabilitating young offenders is increasingly being passed on to parents.
I have to pay a public defender fee, juvenile investigation fee, and then the supervision fee.
And we'll take a look at the increasing use of GPS ankle monitors for young people.
I do get frustrated because I feel like I'm trapped in my own house.
A special report from our partners at Youth Radio. That's coming up today on Cross Currents. California's criminal justice system has come under a lot of fire for its overcrowded prisons and skyrocketing costs. But we don't often hear as much about the young people locked up in our state. California has the largest overall population of incarcerated youth in the country. In a series called Double Charged, reporters from Youth Radio spent the past year looking into the state's juvenile justice system, trying to calculate the price, both emotional and financial, on young offenders and their families. When a young person is arrested for a crime, the wheels of the juvenile justice system start turning. Court appearances and jail time, maybe even programs to rehabilitate. But there's another, less discussed step. It's called restitution. That's when convicted juveniles are required to pay their victims back financially. In California, there's no limit to how much restitution can be required, but many young offenders came from families that don't have a lot of money. As Youth Radio's Sarah Quevedo reports, this system often fails both offenders and their victims.
Just that right there. There's just a little burn mark on the floor.
Ricky Brum is standing with one of my producers in an alleyway behind a furniture store in Manteca, California. And to be honest, it's a little awkward. He doesn't really want to be here. Last February, Brum set some cardboard boxes on fire just a few feet away.
So how many boxes would you say? About like 4 or 5?
No, it was filled with boxes, like probably like 7. Mm. 7 littler boxes inside of a big box.
Just one match did it, or was it like several?
No, it was just one. Like, I just sat there and I was like, bam.
That bam changed Ricky Brum's life. He was 15 when he set the fire, and it was his first time getting in trouble with the law. He was lucky. His charges were reduced to a misdemeanor. He went on probation and served no time in juvenile hall. Brum and his mom, Leanne, thought the worst was behind them. But then, while meeting with their public defender, they found out about restitution.
They gave us this big packet of papers.
And we thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
And she said, no, it's not a joke. I said, really? They can do this? She said, well, they can ask.
Sitting at his kitchen table, Ricky Brum flips through the restitution claim. It's got nearly 1,400 items. Even though the fire department's report says there was no damage to anything in the furniture store, the owner claimed his entire inventory was smoke damage.
All right, we got table lamp, $149. Sectional sofa, $2,000. King mattress set, $997.
Brum's family is fortunate. They own a house and have homeowners insurance. And the insurance company went to bat for them, negotiating the restitution down to $10,000, which their insurance paid for. Christine Kroger, Ricky Brum's attorney, says the bill was originally $221,000.
Which is impossible for a kid to pay.
Some states limit restitution for juveniles, but in California, there are no limits to how much money minors can owe victims, often on top of serving time behind bars.
A lot of people give lip service to rehabilitation of the minor, but what we see is it's all about punishment. For example, there's a whole caseload of kids who have satisfied every other term and condition of their probation, but they just don't get off probation because they still owe money.
Restitution can't be erased by claiming bankruptcy, and if it still exists by the time offenders turn 21, it can turn into a civil judgment. Victims can garnish up to 25% of offenders' wages, can take their tax refunds, and place liens on property.
So they were out here swimming, having their little barbecue.
That's Sue Ann Coster. Her grandson threw a pool party at her house while she and her husband were away. The grandson was in high school, and one of the teens who went over to swim came back and robbed her.
I was recuperating from breast cancer, and I had done a year of chemo, and my husband had said he wanted to take me for a little trip. Well, when I came back, I was not only a victim of cancer, but I was a victim of a burglary.
The teen stole jewelry, including her husband's wedding band and a necklace Koster got as an anniversary gift. Koster says she had to fight the Yolo County DA's office to get them to go after the teen for restitution. And when she was in court, she says the teen
turned and spit. The hardest spit I've ever seen. Now, that's intimidation. He was trying to intimidate me to not pursue things. Well, he did not realize that the more he did that, the more I was determined. You know, you little punk, you're not gonna intimidate me.
Koster won $2,600 restitution for the stolen jewelry. But there was also another $6,000 for things like mileage, lost wages, and the cost of new security upgrades to her home, including spaying and neutering her new watchdogs, Dorothy and Toto. The offender still owes Koster about $1,000 in interest, but has otherwise paid the restitution in full. And payment is rare. There are no statewide statistics on juvenile restitution, but Youth Radio collected numbers from three of California's largest counties and found that less than 30% of restitution amounts are paid.
I think people recognize there are certain dollar amounts that are just not going to be paid at all, ever.
Roger Chan runs the East Bay Children's Law Offices in Oakland. Juvenile law, says Chan, is about reform, giving young people a chance to start over. But he argues restitution too often gets in the way because it saddles kids with unreasonably high debt. He's trying to change California's law to let judges consider a kid's ability to pay. Chan says it's not just for the benefit of young offenders. It's for victims, too, because when restitution sums are realistic, victims are more likely to get paid.
If you order such a huge amount of restitution to a young person who has no ability to pay it, how meaningful is that as a consequence? Is that really an effective way for the young person to be rehabilitated? Is that also something that's really beneficial to victims?
To say that juvenile restitution is complicated is an understatement. It's a process that wrestles with two competing philosophies around the idea of justice. Justice for victims who have the right to be paid for their losses, even when the offender spends time in jail. And justice for juvenile offenders who need to be held accountable, but also allowed to move on from their crimes and from the system. For Cross Currents, I'm Ser Quevedo.
That story was part of Double Charged, a special investigation into the California juvenile justice system produced by Youth Radio in Oakland. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. We just heard about how families struggle to pay back the victims of their kids' crimes. But that isn't the only thing parents are asked to pay for. In California and elsewhere, they're increasingly required to take on more of the costs of their child's incarceration. One problem with that? Incarcerated children are more likely to come from low-income families, according to Youth Radio in this investigative series, Double Charged. In this next report, Youth Radio's Miles Best looks at the impact of fines and fees on parents who are least likely to be able to pay.
Standing in the hallway outside a hearing room at the Alameda County Juvenile Justice Center, you see benches filled with teenagers and their families, waiting to appear in court. Many dressed up in button-downs and ties, looking their Sunday best. A lot of moms, too, and little brothers and sisters who'd clearly rather be elsewhere. Many teens are here for trials and probation hearings. But on any given day, others are trying to negotiate fines and fees. The bill starts adding up before the courtroom, when you're arrested. Even if you're innocent, in Alameda County, the investigation alone will cost you $250.
You get fines for the public defender. You get charged for incarceration.
That's Deborah Mendoza, probation officer turned advocate, who can list fees off the top of her head.
And there's a fee for being in juvenile hall. There's a daily fee for if you're on GPS.
If you total the average fees for a juvenile, it's close to $2,000.
And it becomes this just machine that seems to be, hopeless.
It's parents who are responsible for the bill, and that's the trend across the country. legal scholar Lauren Brookeisen from NYU's Brennan Center for Justice.
There are more and more criminal justice fees that are added every single year in this country. In recent years, about 20 state legislatures passed laws holding parents responsible for their children's crimes.
In California, parents have the right to negotiate fees, but it's not easy. If they don't pay, officials can garnish parents' wages, take their tax refunds, or place liens against their property.
Sometimes it is more expensive administratively to collect these fees than the money you're actually receiving in revenue. And that is the great irony of the situation.
In Alameda County, one of the poorest in the San Francisco Bay Area, half of the fees charged to parents remain unpaid. That's according to the county's own data, based on a recent five-year period.
My immediate thought was like, whoa, like how are we going to do this? How are we going to pay this off? It's a lot of money.
When Miguel Garcia was 14, he stole a car. He was put on probation in order to attend an alternative to jail program, which he completed. He thought he could put his bad decisions behind him. But then at a court date where he hoped for closure, he found out his family still owed something for his crime. Money.
I didn't know what to do. I felt like guilty because my mom was sitting next to me. I just looked at my mom like she was pretty upset.
The total bill was $800. Garcia says that's high for his family, especially since his mom was unemployed at the time.
Step over to my office.
Back at the courthouse, Joshua Hopkins is sitting on a bench waiting to be called into a hearing. Hopkins is 13, but he looks a lot older.
People mess with me and then they get me frustrated, and then I fight.
The fighting has led to time in juvenile detention, and that adds up to a lot of fees, according to his mom, LaPortia John.
I have to pay a public defender fee, juvenile investigation fee, and then the supervision fee, and then the juvenile institution. So I owe a total of $736.
Miss John owes the money, even though her son's not in her care. Because of a mental health issue, Joshua lives in a private group home. But his mom is still responsible for the court fees when he messes up.
He's my son, but I ask for help, and I'm getting hurt because it's financially creating a hardship.
That's part of being a parent. You know, you're responsible for your kids and their actions.
That's Terry Wiley, Assistant District Attorney for Alameda County's Juvenile Division. If young people and their families have a problem paying, Wiley says there's a straightforward solution.
Don't be committing crimes and you won't owe any money. Very simple.
For Zoe Matthews, it's not simple at all. In 2010, her son Deshaun Morris was incarcerated for the better part of a year. Months after being released from jail, he was shot and killed. Her son was dead, but the debt lived on, including ongoing calls from county collections.
It's a constant reminder that no, he's not here anymore.
Matthew's son was locked up for 208 days at a cost of almost $30 a day.
By being incarcerated, you're paying your debt back to society. So then they're going to charge you an additional per night stay as if there were some options. The bills are additional stress to already a very painful situation that I will be dealing with for the rest of my life.
Matthew says the county has agreed to reduce her monthly payment, but won't reduce the total bill, $7,500, for her deceased son's fees. For Cross Currents, I'm Miles Best.
That story comes to us from Youth Radio. It's part of their year-long investigation, Double Charged, examining the real cost of juvenile justice. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News, I'm Ben Trefney. We've been hearing about how the costs of the juvenile justice system get passed on to families. There's a new tactic in youth justice. A growing number of courts are sentencing young offenders to GPS ankle monitoring rather than jail time. But as Youth Radio's Sarah Quevedo reports, the lower cost of ankle bracelets may be leading to their overuse.
17-year-old Alyssa Morris Jackson is sitting on the couch in sweatpants and a hoodie.
It's 7 o'clock right now.
7 each evening is the time when about 130 juvenile offenders in Alameda County, California, are required to plug in for their mandatory 2-hour battery charge.
See? I'm dead. No charge. I'm going to be so excited to get this thing off me.
Jackson has a GPS monitor fastened around her ankle with a rubber strap. It's part of her probation. The GPS unit is black and plastic, about the size and shape of a computer mouse. Its purpose? To track her every movement. And that information ends up here. Here at the Juvenile Justice Center in San Leandro, California, a probation officer named Chris shows me how GPS monitors work.
We use Google Maps, and it shows real time.
We're looking at the digital breadcrumbs of one teenager's movements since he was released from juvenile hall earlier today. The map shows the teen's path out of the building to the parking lot, then down the hill to the freeway.
From here, freeway, from the freeway 580.
Show him how you make it get right down.
So I can get down right to the home.
You can even tell if he's in the front yard or the backyard.
Front yard, everything.
The probation officer drags a green circle over the kid's home. It's got a radius of 150 feet. Outside of that, it'd be a GPS violation, and a judge could send him back to juvenile hall or lengthen probation. Teens on GPS monitoring have to call their probation officer before they leave for school in the morning. And anything outside of school and home requires special permission at least 48 hours in advance. So it's basically house arrest.
The benefits of GPS are people are not incarcerated.
Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley says GPS also saves the county money because it costs way less than locking kids up. That's $429 a day. GPS, only $85.
So when they originally were building a new juvenile justice center, the original idea was that it was going to be more than 500 beds. And I think on any given day now, there are less than 200.
But the devices cost families money, up to $15 a day. And electronic monitoring, like GPS, has more than tripled in the last 10 years.
It is absolutely overused.
Dominique Pinckney is a public defender in Alameda County. He argues that judges assign GPS almost reflexively, even to teens who never would have been sent to juvenile hall. And he says teens get in trouble for silly reasons, like not keeping their device properly charged or hanging out with friends.
When you extend the consequence beyond some rational period, it becomes abusive, it makes kids angry, and so you engage in a battle instead of sending a corrective signal.
Nearly half of the young people who are electronically monitored end up violating the terms, according to a study cited by the American Bar Association. A quarter cut the device off entirely. 16-year-old Manny Velasquez is waiting outside of a courtroom. Besides his towering spiked hair, the most noticeable thing about him is the GPS monitor that's been strapped around his ankle for the past 2 months.
I am ashamed of it, but that's not stopping me, like, for being myself, of the way I dress.
He says the worst part is the isolation.
Sometimes I do get frustrated because I feel like I'm trapped in my own house. And just last night, I felt like the walls were closing in on me.
One courtroom away, 15-year-old Cameron Lopes has just met with a judge. He was caught carrying a pocket knife in school and says he spent 4 days in juvenile hall, then strapped with the GPS unit for 30 days. Today, he and his dad, Jamie, were hoping they could get the device taken off.
He didn't get his GPS off today.
I'm pissed. I've been trying real hard, and they just throw all the bad stuff in, never the good stuff.
If he yelled at somebody, they brought it up, you know. They didn't bring up that he was on the honor roll and, you know, stuff like that. It's just all the negative stuff. So another 30 days.
Just 4 days before that 30 days was up, Cameron Lopes got into an argument with his dad and cut off his GPS monitor. He's been in juvenile hall for almost a month. Judges, DAs, and public defenders are in rare agreement that GPS tracking is a good alternative to incarcerating teenagers. And it does save money. But for the young people being monitored, the technology may be solving one problem and creating others, like extending their time in the criminal justice system. For Cross Currents, I'm Sarah Cavedo.
You're listening to Double Charged, a special investigation into the costs of juvenile justice from our partners at Youth Radio in Oakland. You can find links to these reports at kalw.org. And if you have a story to share with us, call 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. Reporters Sarah Quevedo and Miles Best from Youth Radio spent the last year looking into the state's juvenile justice system to bring us these stories. I sat down with them to find out more about their reporting process and what reforms might be able to change the problems they uncovered. I began by asking Sarah what surprised him during the reporting.
So I guess if I'm going to talk specifically about GPS, I was surprised by a lot of things. I think I was surprised mostly about how restrictive it is. Because you hear this in the story, one of the young people that we spoke to, Cameron Lopes, he like couldn't mow his lawn. He wasn't able to leave his house. He had to call 48 hours in advance to get permission to mow his lawn, and even then it was, you know, like maybe 2 hours or so. You know, and also just the way that different young people think about GPS as well. We spoke to Alyssa, who's at the beginning of our story, and she says it's frustrating to have this monitor, but it reminds me that I have this and not to get in trouble. But then we also spoke to other young people like Manny who were like, this is suffocating. I can't stand having this on me. And so it's a really very different kind of different perspectives and different views on the device itself. I think that was one of the most surprising things.
That's Sarah Quevedo. He and Miles Best are reporters on the Double Charged series from Youth Radio. So, Miles, you did the story that was looking at the impact of fines and fees on the families of minors. If the fees are not being collected, if the fines aren't being collected because people can't pay them or they can't pay them in a timely way, then what happens? What's the consequence at that point?
You stay on probation, and it's like an endless loop. Because it's like you can't get off probation for one, like if your restitution isn't paid, right? And then in addition to that, those other fees can continue to pile on. And you can't get off probation without those other fees being paid off.
So the
until you're 21. And then it becomes, what is it called again? A
civil judgment.
Civil judgment.
And that means that essentially the victim can file a motion to put a lien on your home, can also take 25% of your wages. Can take your tax refunds. And like I said before you can't get it sealed until you've got paid off all the money, and you can't get off probation until you've paid this off, which obviously makes it harder to get jobs and housing.
That's Sarah Quevedo. He and Miles Best reported on the Double Charged series from Youth Radio. So what's the main takeaway that you guys have after reporting this series? What do you want people to think about or know about that you want to come across in doing this work? Miles, why don't you start?
Personally, one thing that I gained from this was perspective, because when I first joined the story, I interviewed a lot of the juveniles, and it's kind of easy to just take their sides, you know what I mean? When you hear a 14-year-old talking about, like, I can't pay these thousands of dollars, I can't afford this, it's stressful on my family, blah, 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 my mother, you know, and it's like all these different, you know, financial restrictions. And then on the flip side, hearing how the victims and how it's damaged them, how it's damaged their family life, how it's damaged them emotionally and mentally and things like that. So one thing that I wanted to take away was perspective and just seeing all the avenues that this, I don't want to call it a problem, but that this situation can lead to if mishandled.
And Sarah, what's something that you saw as maybe a way in which the system could be improved?
There are a couple of things. I think if I can talk specifically about restitution and GPS. So with restitution, at least, there one of the ways that it can be improved is kind of a better accountability system, because we heard from lawyers of this thing. It's called a windfall. Just kind of going back here, restitution is for the losses a victim incurs because of a crime. But if that victim already has insurance and that insurance pays them, they can also be paid by the offender. And there's no accountability system checking in to see that they've been, you know, that they've already been paid by insurance and by the young person. And so they can end up getting a windfall. So they get kind of twice the money that they had originally asked for. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, victims are also able to kind of exaggerate or make up claims. And it can be really difficult to challenge those claims because, you know, how do you prove someone didn't have something to begin with? So, you know, one example is there was one case that we were told about. From a lawyer who says that there was a man who got his car stolen, and he
the CDs, right?
Yeah, exactly. So he basically said, look, I had a folio of CDs, 100 CDs that were stolen from this car, and he made a list of all of the CDs, and he turned this in. He was going to get restitution for them. And the lawyer went and looked over the list and realized that there were actually duplicate CDs within the list, and even CDs that hadn't even been released
at the time that
this guy had stolen his car.
Whoops.
And so it can be, you know, unless you have someone who's diligently looking over everything like that, it can be, you know, it can be really hard to challenge those claims.
That's Sarah Quevedo and Miles Bess from Youth Radio in Oakland. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Louisa Beck, Daniel Moore, Audrey Dilling, Lawrence Chan, Jeannie Dwan, Leela Day, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, Liza Veal, and Melanie Young. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer is Sandhya Dirks. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. We had additional engineering support from Chris Hoff. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And because of your support, we can proudly say we are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.